The current U.S. Prescription Drug User Fee Act, commonly referred to as PDUFA 5, will sunset at the end of 2017. In July 2015, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration held its first public meeting on PDUFA reauthorization in the context of negotiations on the provisions of PDUFA 6. In her remarks, Center for Drug Evaluation and Research Director Dr. Janet Woodcock said, quote, PDUFA has been generally considered successful. We continue to meet or exceed nearly all our application review goals, and these accomplishments are in part made possible by the resources provided by this program, unquote. I am Alberto Grignolo, Deputy Editor of the IA's Global Forum. Today, I am joined by Dr. Woodcock and by Dr. Teresa Mullen, Director of FDA's Office of Strategic Programs, to discuss the reauthorization of PDUFA and its progress to date. Thank you very much for being with us. If I may ask the first question, Dr. Woodcock, Title 9 of PDUFA 5 was devoted to enhancing regulatory science and expediting drug development. How has Title 9 facilitated or perhaps challenged your work at FDA?
Sure. Well, before I get into Title 9, let me just talk about what PDUFA really is in the strict sort of government sense. So it's the Prescription Drug User Fee Program, and many people on the outside don't understand this. In the congressional process, user fees are just that. They're fee for service. So the industry can pay additional money to get particular services done by the government. It isn't a tax whereby the money can just be used for anything. And so it couldn't be used for things that weren't services to the industry. And I think people often lose sight of that in thinking about PDUFA. So Title IX tried to do a number of things that would help the industry and help drug development and also assist the agency. There was efforts on enhancing communication between FDA and the sponsors during drug development. And we think that's been very successful. That's cut down the work at the end, even on behalf of patients, so that things go smoothly and the trials that are done correctly and to meet our standards and so forth. The science of meta-analysis methodologies, that's one where we want to advance the putting studies together so that we can answer questions that any single study alone might not be able to answer, and that's a statistical effort. The use of biomarkers and pharmacogenomics, which is another part of that, is something that is extremely important to us, and we have had some difficulty, I think, in hiring in that area because these are specialized people that we're trying to get, but this is a whole field that between the industry and us, we really need more effort, scientific effort put in. So that's been challenging to us, as you said, as well as facilitating. Same with the development of patient-reported outcomes and other endpoint assessment tools. This isn't a field that's well enough and rigorously enough developed in the outside world, say in academia and so forth. There are a lot of academic tools out there, but they may not have the rigor that is necessary to use for decision making in drug development. And so we're trying to move the field in that direction so that we have more tools to assess really how the patients feel. And then advancing the development of drugs for rare diseases, that really enabled us. We've hired staff. We have a rare disease group, and they're focusing on things like small clinical trials and the other things that are needed for rare diseases. So, Teresa?
I can just add to that that some of the challenges that we faced and we learned from and have built on in the next in our negotiations over the past year that we've conducted with industry and with public stakeholder input is that we, as Dr. Woodcock has said, the communication during development has been very successful and the rare disease program, and we're building on that and going to be continuing those programs going forward. And what we've also learned from PDUFA 5 is that more work is needed on methodology and greater clarity to industry and even in our review standards and what we want to take in for both biomarker area and for patient-reported outcomes and other kinds of clinical outcome assessment measures, as they're called. And we got some resourcing for these things in PDUFA 5. One of the challenges for us has been hiring. The hiring system in the federal government often doesn't anticipate that you're going to need these new emerging expertise and technical skills that we need. And so that's been a little bit of a disconnect and a challenge for us. And again, that's another area that we're trying to learn from, and we're addressing with enhancement going forward in the next authorization, we hope, of PDUFA. And so, you know, that's, I think that that gives you a good sense to your question of where has the challenge been in the current authorization.
Thank you, Dr. Mullen. If I may just follow up very briefly, are there any brand new initiatives premised under PDUFA 6 in relation to enhancing or expediting drug development, anything that wasn't in PDUFA 5?
Yes, I can go ahead and answer that. And there is the same heading you've probably seen, the draft letter. We call it the commitment letter, which has been posted on our website, so you can see the full text. But indeed, in fact, in PDASIA 2012, which is the larger omnibus in which PDUFA authorization was one of the titles, it was Title I of PDASIA, there was a provision for a breakthrough therapy designation, and statute had provided for a new program, but there was no resourcing to cover it. Now, it turns out this is a very successful program. We think it's successful. Our industry very much likes it. So what we'll be adding in this area of the PDUFA enhancements is a sustained success of that breakthrough program. And this primarily, as Dr. Woodcock said, PDUFA is as much about resourcing success mm-hmm. as indicating what specifically we're going to do and strive to do. So in this case, it was a matter of continue the program. It's well specified already, but provide more resources for it. In addition to that, gaining the success of breakthrough therapy, we have a provision added for clarifying the approach for early sponsor consultations with FDA regarding the use of new biomarkers that they want to use as a new surrogate endpoint. It's to clarify what they need to do and reduce the uncertainty they may have and that we would have by what they need to provide by way of evidence in development and how to do that. In addition, there's a provision to enhance the development of drug-led and biologics led combination product reviews. So that would be drug device and biologic device combination products to enhance that process and provide some time frames and additional resourcing there. And finally, the other area is to enhance the use of real-world evidence in regulatory decision-making. This is a somewhat new area, so some of this is exploratory to understand better, have discussions in public workshops and pilot some efforts there to see where that type of evidence and what kind of evidence can be used for what kinds of decisions.
Thank you. You mentioned breakthrough therapy, which segues nicely into my next question, and that is some people applaud accelerated regulatory approvals for providing quicker access, while other people question if accelerating approval may compromise regulatory science or provide less data than might otherwise be the case. So I wanted to ask you, what is your perspective on this access versus evidence debate? Do you think this topic is something that PDUFA 6 should address? And if so, how?
No, because PDUFA 6 isn't about policy, and that's one thing we're very clear about. As Teresa said, it's about resources and fees, what services we could provide for fees. It's not about our standard at all, and we strictly stay away from that because we're negotiating with industry. The standards are something we work out with Congress and through our public process of regulation. But to talk about that, I mean, every drug approval is a prediction of efficacy or effectiveness. We predict the drug's going to work, and you can be more or less certain about that prediction. And if you want to be really, really certain that the drug works, you reduce your chance of what's called type one error, the mistake that you thought the drug worked when it didn't. But at the same time, you increase your chance by having a high bar of making a type 2 error, of failing to approve a drug that really did work. And so making a type 1 error we try to avoid, and that's what they're talking about in this debate you're talking about, but you don't want to make a type 1 error for a drug like that has a lot of alternatives to treat a minor condition. There are other drugs out there you could do or other modalities. But on the other hand, when you have a serious or you have a life-threatening disease, has no treatment, then you might not want to make a type 2 error or fail to approve a drug that really could help people. Therefore, if you are more concerned about that, then you might have to lighten up a little bit on your concern about a type 1 error. And most mm-hmm. people who have sensible discussions about this, in my mind, understand the spectrum and understand that the amount of certainty is on a spectrum depending on other factors, such as how severe the disease is and how many alternative treatments there are and so forth, and how immediately life-threatening the disease is. So those people say who are advocating for a right to try, for example, they say we'd like to try anything. We don't care how much uncertainty there is because we have one certainty, and our certainty is we're dying unless we find something, right? And so they have some point there. I mean, it's not a crazy position to take, right? On the other hand, people who, you know, want medicine for their hypertension or lower their cholesterol, they say, well, we want to have a really safe, really well-proven, effective medicine because there are lots of ways to do this. And I think the problem is dichotomizing this and saying, oh, they all have to, we have to have the same degree of confidence for every drug. And that clearly isn't the case. And that's what we say in our regulations on expedited programs.
To follow up, if I may, you mentioned real-world evidence a few minutes ago. How might the accelerated approval pathways intersect, if you will, or be complemented by real-world evidence? Would that be a helpful binomial or not a helpful one?
It really depends on the circumstances. In some cases, you can tell by real-world evidence that a drug is working, okay, because the natural history is clear and the people, maybe it takes longer, but they deviate from the natural history over time more and more. And in some cases, it won't be because the differences are too subtle. And in those cases, you know, we require companies who get accelerated approval to do confirmatory trials post-marketing. For example, sometimes that's hard. For example, in oncology, if there's no alternative therapies, we've approved a drug, they're not going to be able to do a placebo-controlled trial in that population because the patients are going to want to take the drug. I would. But they do it in a different stage of the disease or something like that. So there are ways to get around it and all still confirm that the drug it works and is effective and so forth. And in some cases, as I said, where the natural history is very clear, we might actually do what you'd call accelerated approval. We approve the drug early on a surrogate, and if you wait long enough, it'll become clear. If you follow those patients in a registry or whatever, it'll become clear they've deviated from the natural history of the disease.
How does the patient voice figure into all of this?
Well, you know, it's the first chapter we did. Teresa spearheaded that in PDUFA 5. Where we actually got the patient-focused drug development meeting started. And I think we learned so many things from them about how patients really are experts in their disease and how we that expertise isn't let into the process in a way that is real meaningful, but also it's going to be hard to incorporate that. You know, we learned that, you know, the things people care about may not be the things we measure in treating a disease, not because of the FDA, but because disease treatment has been doctor-centric, right? And then sometimes they design trials that are just impossible for people to participate in meaningfully and are just a nightmare. And often they could have been changed to be reasonable for patients and so forth. So I think in PDUFA 6, we're going to try to move toward more formal, rigorous, structured way of getting all this information so we can use it.
No, I can only just echo what Dr. Woodcock has said. You know, PDUFA 5 was a great culture shift for us. I think an opportunity for people to really hear, and I've heard this from many outside stakeholders, that having FDA pay attention to what patients are saying directly, very powerful sort of symbolically for them as well, and it energized that community. And now, of course, they want to know what else can we do.
Right.
So these initial meetings are great. But as Dr. Woodcock says, our challenge and our logical next step is how do we go from those powerful anecdotes to a set of measures that are fit for purpose and we can and bring into clinical trials that things that are the most meaningful measures to patients that are also going to move with the therapy so they'll reflect the impact of the therapy. And we can start to directly get evidence and sponsors can collect evidence, reduction of disease burden and maybe also measure treatment burden in clinical trials. And then that evidence can be submitted to FDA and then we can really use that as a basis for decision making and could potentially even go into labeling and be valuable to providers making decisions with patients downstream in the healthcare system. So that's a big piece. Also, as Dr. Woodcock said, so we're going to have a series of guidances related to that in PDUFA 6 with workshops to proceed that to get the input of everyone in the community to help inform that guidance. And in addition to that, we're going to have a third party conduct a meeting where patients and their families can tell us about the best practices and things that matter most to them to be able to even participate in trials because it's very critical that trials consider what patients need logistically and how to inform consent can be made meaningful and so on, things that matter to patients. Build a repository so everyone can benefit from the information that can be publicly shared, and we minimize duplication of efforts. And really, most importantly here, another really key piece, and it goes back to why this is a user fee issue, is that we have very limited capacity in this area right now, and it requires some specialized technical skills to help review and even advise people on the development of these kinds of instruments to be used in trials. We have very few people, a handful literally, who do this right now. So in PDUFA 6, we'll have the resources, and we will make a concerted effort to increase our staff capacity so we're really able to enable this work to continue to expand.
Yeah, and this is Janet Woodcock again. And the another area that we're interested in and that CDRH has been pursuing a bit is when you ask about the uncertainty and how much we should tolerate and so forth, patient preferences as far as how much uncertainty are they willing to tolerate, how much about, say, efficacy, how much uncertainty about risk, how much risk are they going to be willing to accept for a certain amount of benefit. And generally speaking, in the medical model, the doctors have decided what those things might be. And now in the modern world, though, it really is recognized, I think, that patients should be able to make those trade-offs themselves. But we need to hear more from the community. And in any disease area, there are going to be people on all parts of the spectrum of risk tolerance and also different trade-offs for uncertainty. So what we need to do is maybe collect that information, understand how to display that so people can make their own decisions.
Thank you very much for those details. Let me move to the final question, and it has to do with the clinical research system. We often hear that in the U.S. the clinical research system is, quote, broken, unquote. How could PDUFA 6 help fix this so-called broken system, which Commissioner Califf has even described as clunky at the recent DIA annual meeting? What is your point of view?
Well, I think that the clinical research enterprise in the United States is a much bigger thing than just what we're doing under PDUFA. And so certainly some of the things we're working on in real-world evidence and incorporating real-world evidence should help with one thing that needs to be done, which is moving the clinical research system, which is done over here, and the clinical care system, which is done over there, and trying to move those together so that we can get information from clinical care and do research in clinical care, and that'll be very important. But other efforts, what we're doing with NIH on clinical research and developing a common protocol like for investigators, what the Transcelerate organization is doing in developing for industry, common protocols, common templates for agreement. We feel that, and this isn't in PDUFA necessarily, but I feel, all right, that clinical trial networks should be the future, standing networks that can evaluate many different therapies, investigational or approved. So we are helping move toward that, and PDUFA is helping us in a sense because many of these are investigational products that are worked on in these networks. So, but it is a bigger, much bigger issue, and it has to do with, you know, the medical centers and how they do things and how investigators are rewarded or fail to be rewarded and the lack really of funding for clinical investigation, the lack of prestige as far as tenure, the fact that the pharmaceutical companies haven't taken a systematic approach to this, which they are now in Transcelerate. But up till then, they've done their own thing, which has caused a great degree of fragmentation, as everybody knows. And so it is kind of something that just grew up, and it's quite chaotic and expensive and prone to error.
And you're suggesting this goes well beyond PDUFA 6?
No, yes, well beyond.
Dr. Mullen, any comment on that question?
The only thing I would add, and again, it's only in the limited context of PDUFA, so think clinical research to support the development of a drug and data for regulatory submissions, would be the data standards work that we have begun under PDUFA 5, and we've got industry support in PDUFA 5 to go ahead and have a provision in FDASIA that allows FDA to use binding guidance to require that data standards be used on the submissions. And this has got a rather powerful effect because it requires that industry standardize their data and that they all use the same data standards. And that may have a crossover effect or a beneficial effect beyond, but it certainly will at least that research that's done to support, ultimately support a submission to FDA will be standardized data. And that's probably a beneficial piece that would go along with what Dr. Woodcock described.
Yes, because, of course, everyone is discussing data interoperability and data availability, but it doesn't make much use to make your data available if you're a clinical investigator if nobody understands how you set up the metadata and how you set up the analyses and what choices you made. So I just read something by a statistical investigator who said he went back and tried to analyze an older study he'd been involved in, and he couldn't remember, you know, some of how the codes were set up, right? And he said,
right.
If I'm having trouble doing this, just imagine I just give this data set to somebody else. So it isn't as easy as one thinks, but we will be able to put these standardized data, the clinical data and the animal data, in our JANUS database because they're standardized, and then we'll be able to do cross-study analyses and so forth that might be, in the future, may be very beneficial.
And the two other components I can mention in PDUFA 6 that may have some bearing, again, limited, but some bearing, especially for the drug regulatory, those affected by drug regulation, okay, studies for that purpose, for regulatory submissions would be our capacity to review complex innovative trial designs, which is an area that we think we'll be able to help encourage by having more capacity and producing some guidance, and building our capacity to support analysis data standards. So this is the statistical data set standards, which need to be, as Dr. Woodcock was saying, correct and the same in order to use powerful statistical analysis tools. So those would help as well.
Right. And finally, since our time is almost up, let me ask you in an open-ended fashion, is there anything that we have not asked you that you would like to share with our listeners in relation to PDUFA 6 or any other matters?
Well, with regard to PDUFA 6, I think that I would say that we are very excited about the enhancements that have been negotiated and are looking forward to timely process for reauthorization to make use of the enhancements and proceed with the enhancements that we've talked about today and then some others. I didn't actually mention the hiring challenges. We've included some first time ever enhancements to the hiring system to try to enable us to more effectively bring in that top scientific talent that we need to help oversee this very important work.
Well, Dr. Woodcock, Dr. Mullin, thank you so much for speaking with the DIA Global Forum today. On behalf of DIA, thank you both for sharing your time and your insights with our listeners.